To learn about even more upcoming events, visit our website at townhallseattle.org or pick up a calendar at our membership table. So thank you all again very much for being here. Just a few quick notes. The event we have going on upstairs tonight is going to be fantastic. It's a global rhythms event. There are a lot of drums, so if you hear or sense any loud rumbling, that's what that is. And Project Pilgrimage has some information at this table over here. And then Quest and Akita also have some merch and books for sale and information on this side as well. So please feel free to stop by those tables afterwards. And apologies for the bit of technical jumping here on the projector. We're still working out some kinks, so if you can ignore it as much as you possibly can. Introducing tonight's event is Felicia Ishino, the Executive Director of Project Pilgrimage. Please welcome Felicia.
From various backgrounds, they have a wide range of experiences, Some of them were involved in the civil rights movement. Some of them are working with Black Lives Matter organizations. And some of them work to remove white supremacy symbols across the South, like our guest tonight. What is really important to me about the pilgrimage experience and why I wanted to share this with you is because we really focus on difference and bridging those differences. My personal experience is as a Black woman whose parents are interracial. I have a Japanese father and a Black mother. I have a white partner. I have Black children, sons and a daughter. And I know that difference is important. I know uplifting difference is important, but I also know that many people live in fear when it comes to difference. The work of Project Pilgrimage is to counter that and to make sure that we're bringing people together to at least have a conversation and to identify ways to create change. And that's the type of world I want to live in, where different people can be together and can work together. That's what I've learned on pilgrimages from people like Quest. So if you're wondering, how do you join a pilgrimage? We are currently preparing our upcoming pilgrimage, and I encourage you to go to our website, projectpilgrimage.org. You can get information on that table. We are completely donor-supported. We try to find ways to make this experience as accessible as possible to everyone and anyone. We don't want this experience to just be limited to those who can afford something like this. So if you're hesitating, please don't. Just reach out to us and find out, and we'll work with you. The pilgrimage really is for everyone. So over the years, I've had the really good fortune to meet with a scribe called Quest. When he talks to our groups, at the base of a giant pillar, this one, in the center of the city of New Orleans, that once held a statue, it's gone now, of a Confederate soldier, loser, I don't know, they lost, Robert E. Lee. Hearing from Quest at this site is one of the most powerful experiences that I've had. Quest is a poet, an educator, actor, playwright, and activist. He is a two-time national slam poetry championship title winner. He founded Take 'Em Down NOLA, a coalition dedicated to the removal of white supremacist monuments in New Orleans and beyond. Tonight, he is here to bless the stage with a reading from his latest book, Sleeper Cell, and to share with us his thoughts on dismantling the colonial legacy, reflections from a new front line. It's his first time to Seattle, so we gotta, you know, melt that chill that Seattle chili sometimes have and give him a really warm welcome. So, let's try to help out.
Say something back, I'm gonna have to go back home in a little more. Like, we're really chilly up there, like for real. Yeah, for funny. I want to echo everything that Felicia said. Thank y'all. This is amazing. Everybody who's put their hands on this in a communal effort to bring me up here. Like she said, I've been working with Project Pilgrimage by way of Take 'Em Down NOLA Coalition, a coalition that I co-founded, along with some amazing activists and longtime organizers in the city of New Orleans. I'll be telling a bit of our story this evening. Thank y'all for coming out. Y'all could have been anywhere, presumably, on a cold night in Seattle. Y'all chose to come out here and get some of this classwork. Class is in session. So I'm here in this building. It's like, you know, it's not just poetry. I'm staying with a guy, Mark, and he had somebody over fixing his something in the house. And he was like, for whatever reason, he has the name. And yes, it's after the great Tribe Called Quest. But I guess he thought I was a musician. And so he was like, yeah, if you get six people out tonight, then you did it. You arrived. So, man, I arrived, though. You hear, baby? So, yeah, I am going to share a couple of poems with y'all tonight. whole lot of information I'm going to drop with y'all. Feel free to just take it all in, record, take notes, what have you, whatever you feel inspired to do. I will be doing a much more extensive poetry set tomorrow in a third place book. So if you really came for the words and for the poetry, you can meet me there tomorrow night. But for tonight, I really want to get into the story of Taking Down NOLA and the work that we did to remove 4 white supremacist symbols in the city of New Orleans and the implications that has for a lot of other work. And then I look forward to chopping it up with y'all at the end by way of the good sister Nikita. So if you got any questions, I think there's something going around, y'all can, you know, write on your cards or something like that. So before we get into that, I'm going to give y'all a couple of poems. I am traditionally a spoken word artist. Slam poetry has been one of my fortes. We don't do library readings, and even when we do, we bring the slam to the library. So do not feel obligated to sit here and be nice and polite. We've got a couple of things that you can do to let me know you're with me, because it's very performative, and the more energy you give me, the more I can give you back. I am, definitely get over a little something. So if my voice gets a little scratchy tonight, that's why. I'm still trying to give you as close to 100% as I can. However, there's a few things we do in the spoken word world. If you're feeling something, you're here tonight. I think everybody knows this basic one. I'm going to see how it's got to sing. What do you do? All right, here we go. I'm feeling close to home. All right? There's another thing that we do. Well, maybe this is just me. I don't know, but I make audiences do it. Sometimes the word can get really intense. You can get in the weeds with it. You want to hear everything that I'm saying, but you still want to let me know that you're with me. So if you're feeling something that I'm saying, but you don't want to miss a word, you can just rub your hands together. Give me a little bit of friction. It's cold outside. We can all use a little bit of heat. All right? Last but not least, when it comes to poetry, when it comes to activism, this is a sacred space. Whether we're standing in front of this godforsaken pillar towards destruction, then we have to bring some type of good sacred energy too, and pay homage to our ancestors in the form of our activism. Or if I'm at an open mic and I'm just telling the story of my childhood or whatever it is that I need to deal with, that's a sacred space, all right? It's a healing space. And so something we like to say, especially down south, if you're really feeling it, if you feel it all in your guts, if it's saving you like it's been saving us poets, you just give me a little church. I know that might be a foreign tongue. A little southern. But it may be, you know, that's not exactly what you practice. You can also give me mosque. You can give me tabernacle, dojo, whatever the thing is that you do. All right? You can give me ilay. All right? Whatever the thing is that you practice, it's your spiritual space. But if I really take you there tonight, I want you to definitely go there with me. All right? So on the count of 3, can I get some type of spiritual response from you? 1, 2, 3. Ashe. I heard the ashe out there. I hear you. Okay. Wonderful. All right, so last but not least, I want to bring the spirit of my, not personal, but communal ancestor, John Scott, to the building, because he birthed a son who helped create one of the most important open mics that we did in the city. My poetry has been the conduit and road towards my activism, so I'd like to trace those roads back. He said, if you feel or hear anything or appreciate anything that I put to the world, he was an artist and a sculptor, don't thank me, pass it on. So when I ask you, are you ready for the word that I'm going to give you this evening, you're going to respond by saying, pass it on. Y'all ready. Ready to ask it. All right. Are you ready for the word? When they came for me, I was all flailing limbs, bulging eyes, staring through midnight black, with shaky fingers, moistened palms, with trembling teeth, mumbling 23rd songs. Yea, though I spoke my mother's mantras, I found no peace in the valley that my hunters crafted for me. Furrowed brow, eyes white as moonlight, I ran, scared, squirrely tremors in darkness, born of king's blood, lion's heart reduced to conniving rats scurrying through throes of survival, stripped of claws and fang, stripped of mane and pride, my cubs sold in masses where my humanity blocked on stages of human auction when they came for me. I was not surprised. I have known nothing other than quick footfalls and bang of firing metal, shriek shrill and crack of leather lash, swift silence and snap of dangling rope I have never known. Still, I have only known. Post-racial America. A children's story. We need to have a conversation about race. Turns page. We need to have a conversation about race. Turns page. We need to have a conversation about race. Turns page. But we need to have a conversation about pain and gun smoke and blood. Turns page. But we need to and gun smoke, blood, blood. Turns page. But we bang and gun smoke and blood and blood and blood and blood and. Turns page. America. If my name is part your name, so much so in fact that you could fit me inside you. If I am Erica, 6 foot tall, 300 pound brown man, skin Mississippi mud, voice Italian accented as any New York native, does my perfect blend of melting pot miscegenation not garner enough respect for you to not choke me to death in broad daylight? It's not Matador, your manic nightmares will be out of plain view if I am Sean. Wedding bells ringing in my very near future. Will it buy me enough time for you to not permanently alter my chances at a happily ever after if I am Michael? As a messenger of God and a born brown. But my message is muted by the bullets of a white cop before it ever gets a chance to mature. Does anyone get a body drop? Or does it just rot like a postmodern dream deferred into a blur of concrete? And what else is new if I am Oscar, worthy of the main stage of life? Will it grant me a nomination of human, a son, a father, a worthy of next breath and a second chance to kiss my wife and lay my daughter down at bed at night without you puppeteering her nightmares for years to come? Do you sleep well at night knowing that my mother never will? Do you rest peacefully knowing that you denied me the chance to do anything but America? What dark phantoms creep in the underbelly of your dream, huh? What ocean of skeletons tap dance around your bed at night? What terror do you dress black bodies in? Do we all turn to bullseyes under your scope? How rigid must be my walk? How docile the smile and timid the eyes to not boil your bloodthirst and jostle your murderous knee-jerk. How articulate must be my speech to match the diction of a genocidal derelict? What you gonna teach my kids, America? About grit, about pull yourself up by your bootstraps when you pulled your empire out of the ashes and dust of bloody black bodies for centuries. What you gonna teach me about nonviolence, about turning of the cheek? Well, with all that blood plastered to your hands and teeth, you hold yourself a national state of emergency a long time ago. But who is to save you when it is the long arms of your own law that strangle your lifespan shorter every day, that make ritual sacrifice of your own citizens every day? Where go these black bodies that your law leaves lifeless? To what god of fear? To what angry, gnashing teeth mouth of hell-born fury? America, if my name is part your name, you are murder of your own tongue, your teeth, the jagged-edged knife devouring your speech, your truth, a blood-soaked venom your children choke on. You are a sadomasochistic suicide letter, a death wish, feeding on itself. You cannot cut off your round nose. Despite your pale face, cannot amputate the Africa from your American body. We will haunt you like phantom limb. We'll be the missing blooms on a rock you can no longer call blood from. We or born to bronze under the warm eye of sun, deemed obscene if we don't bleach our black to oblivion. We, a rhythmic tongue, who dance circles round your dead end linear narrative of murder, death, kill, a perpetual war and rumors thereof. We, We've always been there to serve your whims, America, to quench your bloodthirst and quell the hunger pains in your beastly belly while tap dancing across your fangs, only to find a lonely solace in your cavernous heart, an amphitheater of depraved, waiting to feast on our brown skins. We will no longer dance for you, nor sing your song of death. What will become of you once the minstrel leaves the theater, when you are left bereft of black mammies and pickaninnies to pluck the fear and boredom from your cash crop craniums, America? If my name is part your name, you are continent or cacophonous consonants that will collapse in my absence. Once you vanquish the vowels, we will howl in the wind, reform ourselves nebulous, rain ourselves anew, to fertilize the tomorrows that our earth incubates for us, wade in the waters of her womb, to be reborn and awake of your absence. But we will no longer try to fit ourselves inside of you, America. You can spell out your death sentence alone. So I wrote that piece in the height of the Black Lives Matter movement. And it's a shame that's like a genre at this point. And poetry being the midwife of reality is, I would say, Keats said at one point, it's hard to see how that's also like a genre in movies and popular culture. And it's a fine line and trope, but I don't want to, you know, go down that wormhole. But point being this, we responded to a very pressing reality that we were all confronted by, because, you know, police brutality and violence against black bodies is, you know, like apple pie for black America. Like, we grew up with that, and it's not news to us. But when, you know, the advent of technology made it news to everyone else, it became something that became a national crisis. So what I realized as that moment was bubbling up is that if I was going to engage in the kind of work that was going to confront this, I didn't want to do it in a way that was repetitive, or something that was the same old, same old. I've been watching these kind of marches for Tawana Braley, for Yusuf Hawkins. These are, you know, infamous cases that happened in the 80s in New York, where I grew up. Watching this since, you know, Al Sharpton was in the streets back when it was a little bigger. And so, you know, if I can remember that far back, like, I don't need to, like, replay this narrative in my life. I wanted to give it a different access point and approach it from a deeper way. And it's actually been a really rewarding path, because these monuments were brought to my attention about 2010 and 2011, and there are amazing organizers and activists in the city of New Orleans. Quiet is kept. You know, this is not a new conversation. These things have been resisted since they first were put up there. And I'll talk about the you know, details of the history in a minute. But it was about the next summer, or next spring, when I started to really connect those guys and see how, you know, we live in an environment that's already framed by violence against black bodies. In the city of New Orleans alone, we have at least 17 statues like this. We got 13 now. Still got countless street names, school names, you know, schools that I've worked at that are named after people who either campaigned on, you know, black people not being able to vote, or directly enslaved black people. And then you brand a child with that name and tell them they can be all they can be, right? And so that contradiction was so glaring, we decided to use it as an access point to expand this conversation around Black Lives Matter, because they cannot, if we're made to venerate and hold up and worship these people who told us literally out of Robert Lee's mouth that, you know, slavery is good for Africans. They need this for their civilization, all right? And so that kind of contradiction gave us an opportunity. I call it revolutionary opportunism. We have to be able to exploit moments that present themselves and, you know, give us the opportunity to catalyze the masses. So one more poem real quick. But what happened the next spring that really kind of brought this to attention and made me realize it's a bigger conversation, a bigger problem than even just the black and white situation. I was in Texas, Austin, Texas. Talking about racism, I almost stopped. But to bring it to the core things, I was torn in Texas State Capitol. My small brown body was cast against the canvas of tall white coliseums and things was reaching back centuries. dwarfing in the bleached shadows of their history. With small brown bodies like mine, were but minor details in a portion of American destiny manifest only in the margins, as footnotes on the pages of recorded history. But right now, my thoughts are of Brianna. Brianna of light Latina hue and American college girl humor. She is a walking library of white supremacist mythology trapped in a mausoleum of mestizo skin. Brianna, knowledgeable tour guide who just walked me and some 30 visitors through the pristine halls of the state capitol. The jokes, they glint off of her tongue with irony. Her commentary, it clashes with her culture, and she speaks of Texas history in a possessive. We were defeated in the Battle of the Alamo in 1836, she says. We rallied back 6 weeks later and won the Battle of San Jacinto, thereby founding the great state of Texas, she continues. And I keep trying to figure out how she manages to fit all her light brown me inside of all that Western white we, how she can so easily mix memories of moccasin shoe mamas beneath the steel toes and stairs of Lone Star boots now walking across the marble floors of her oppressor's history as she speaks. There's a festival going on the front lawn of the Capitol. Her voice, it struggles to be heard above the booming bass lines of raggy tone rhythms blaring from the speakers outside. And I can't help but wonder if the cognitive dissonance inside her head doesn't blare just as loudly. There are women, many of them are Brianna's hue, dancing to her people's music. I think they're doing Zumba or the Macarena or something that English words fail to do justice. And I'm struggling to see how she fails to see the injustice in the story she's been paid to propagate. And can she hear her ancestors' rebuttal thumping through the drums as they echo through the halls of the Texas State Capitol? Brianna, can you hear your ancestors calling? At the end of the tour, an elderly white woman asked Brianna, what does the word Texas mean? And she quickly replies, it's a Caddo Indian word for friendship. And I immediately want to look up the word friendship and see if there's anything I missed. Perhaps the etymological references to blood splattered chieftains and trails of tears. Maybe these are key ingredients to lifelong bonds and I'm the oblivious one. Or maybe Texas, just like Louisiana. Like America, like all of the Western wide world, is just a really fucked up friend. The kind of vice grips your bones and it's handshake until your bones are ground to dust and the remains are left to mix with the blood and sweat of capital gains upon the watered down colors that they use to paint the monuments to their greatness. They'll shade you into their shadows, etch your name into the edges of their borders as footnote, loser of the battle, vanquished foe turned mascot, misguided talk out through the halls of another man's history, never his foundation, his keeper of this land before a hostile takeover, his blood rights to this crown before oil rate Texas. If you are friendship, then what do I call my enemies?
Right.
I'm gonna shut the screen. All
right, y'all. So that leads me here. That was 2015. I want to get into the story. I want to talk about taking down Miller. Let's talk about it.
Yes.
Ready for work?
Yes.
All right. I'm still struggling with this voice a little bit, but we're going to do this tonight. Dismantling the Colonial Legacy, Reflections from the New Front Line. So, our great ancestor, James Baldwin, once said, you can snap it up for Jimmy if you need to. The great force of history comes from the fact that we carry it within us, are unconsciously controlled by it in many ways, and history is literally present in all that we do. He went on to say that people are trapped in history. There we go, there we go, Jimmy. He said people are trapped in history, and history is trapped in them. We live at a crossroads in time, where the antiquated colonial narratives of yesteryear, though trapped in us unconsciously, controlling so much of what we do, is ready to crumble under the pressure of our collective resistance. And all it takes is vision expansive enough to see the virus of white supremacist capitalist oppression for what it is, and precise enough to properly diagnose it, and courageous enough to push against it. Visions manifest in terms of people taking to the streets like we've done with the Take a Down a Little Work. So to that end, I want to share with you another poetic vision that inspired me when I was a kid, college kid, a couple of decades ago. Might not look like it, but yeah, that was happening. It was a movie called Slam, starring a poet named Saul Williams. I forgot him in Seattle. I don't need to explain who Saul Williams. So y'all remember the end of the movie where he walks up to the Pentagon, not the Pentagon, the Washington Monument, and he holds his hand up, just quietly, softly, against the backdrop of this 555-foot pillar, right? And that's it, fade to black. That just, like, got in my head when I was, like, 19, right? It puzzled me for years, but it stuck with me, it rested with me. I knew it had to mean something. But, you know, this is the bling era. I was listening to Jay-Z and Cash Money. I had no idea what I was doing. And so it would take a long time before I understood what that was. It was a very small visionary act of resistance, and this is the power of a symbol, right? Because that symbol planted a seed in my heart and my mind. It would take years before, it would fully come to fruition. Years later, I learned the value of that significance, and I came to understand exactly what he was trying to show us. I eventually read a similar text by a black African-American behavioral scientist named Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. She's got a book called The ISIS Papers. Okay, I got some people to sip up here. And in that book, she qualifies symbols as entities that carry highly compacted messages pertaining to the origin, identity, and survival of the individuals and collective messages, or collective peoples, rather. Let me say that again. Symbols she qualifies as entities that carry highly compacted messages pertaining to the origin, identity, and survival of the collective peoples. So, what did that have to do with Saul Williams? In the movie Slam, or white supremacy at large for that matter. Well, the obelisk of the Washington Monument, all right, is also a phallic symbol, all right, that essentially represents white male patriarchy, which is at least one of the underlying forces beneath what we know as white supremacy, because you know that none of this colonization could happen without a militarized force, as it continues to happen today, hashtag hands off Iran. And as it does so, you still have all of these phallic missiles, phallic guns shooting out their bullets. And this is a manifestation of an age-old psychology. That's what started to come to the fore as I started to understand the history of what an obelisk was. To make it even deeper, the obelisk is co-opted from our ancient Kemetic or Egyptian ancestors, as their obelisks were originally called Tekken. So what you're looking at right here is a Tekken, which is the original form of what where Washington Monument's pillar or phallic symbol is derived from. The obelisk also symbolized for the ancient Kemetic people the stability and creative force of the sun god, Ra. So again, this was a male energy, a phallic symbol that it was supposed to embody. So the Washington Monument, created by white men in the center of America's capital, Washington, D.C., standing above the Egyptian obelisk, not only represents white male patriarchal energy, but dominance, and also a co-optation of an age-old African symbolism. The original Elvis, right here. Now, one of the great jewels of wisdom that she drops in the ISIS papers, Dr. Welsing specifically has this to say about the Washington Monument. It is not without significance that the Washington Monument, as a phallic symbol, towers over a predominantly black population in the capital city of the most powerful government in the global white supremacist system. Now, I wanted us to zoom out that wide and that large, not just to grant some insight to my personal entry point into this conversation about white supremacist symbols, but so that as we zoom in on more recent history and on my hometown of New Orleans, Louisiana, we can properly diagnose how vast and age-old this conversation about white supremacist symbols in public spaces truly is. Colonizing culture has been laying down its mark in very covert and overt ways since the inception of so-called Western civilization. It's been codifying its imperialism since Greece invaded Egypt, or Kemet, millennia ago, and since Rome followed them and stole 13 obelisks from Egypt, or Kemet, and placed them in the Roman Empire. In the Caribbean, the region that was first colonized by Western expansion, where the first enslaved Africans were originally bought, that campaign of imperialistic symbolism continues in the form of Christopher Columbus, the original pirate, thief, rapist, murderer of the colonial and imperial era. He still stands in several public squares. When I first delivered this talk, I did so on Trinidad and Tobago, where they are still fighting to get his namesake and his statue removed from what's essentially like their French Quarter. If you've been to New Orleans before, it's in the center of this almost all black and Indian island, and they still have that colonizer symbol there. When I spoke there, I learned that most of the monuments to Columbus were erected between 1880 to 1930. Now, that was done with intention because the white supremacist capitalists of that day had to valorize and lift up their colonial era ancestors in order to validate the next era of Western imperialism that they had on deck, ushered in by the Industrial Age. What's really ironic about that is that Columbus was a loser, even to Spain and Portugal, and the people that employed him to go out and do all that colonizing. He died, I believe, penniless and broke, and failed to achieve any of the missions he was set out to achieve. Didn't even know where he was at. That's why it's the West Indies. He's trying to get there. But all that to say that revisionist history is a mother, right? Because they come back and they venerate this guy like he's a hero, not because they believe so, because they needed oppressed people to believe so. That's black and brown people especially, and impoverished white people, especially in the South as well, and the Caribbean, if they happen to be there. That struck a chord with me. It made me think of a similar campaign that took place around the same time in the American South, where I live. In the U.S., there are over 1,500 known Confederate symbols, all right? But just like trying to document a billionaire's money or black lives that have been eliminated by the state, you can't really trust that number, because first of all, they're qualifying just Confederate symbols. Take them down NOLA and all of our brother sister coalitions around the country, around the world, we talk in terms of white supremacy. So we don't limit it to what happened before 1865 in America, because we have people that were practicing these same things afterwards that were just as detrimental and deleterious to our bodies and our lives. However, this is mostly talking about just the people venerated around the time period of 1861 to 1865, all right, who were in the Confederate Army. We've got just that alone. That doesn't include Andrew Jackson, for example, our president's favorite president, because he preceded that. Well, we know that he died with 143 enslaved people under his ownership, and he was also the author of the Trail of Tears and different, genocidal acts like this. He's just as villainous and just as worthy of being taken down. So in the war, the Confederate Army fought to keep slavery. We know this. When they lost, they promptly spawned a movement called the Cult of the Lost Cause. You can look that up, literally telling on themselves. It existed for the sole purpose of commemorating their Confederate ancestors. Most of the Confederate monuments that exist in America and the South, and primarily came up between 1900 and 1920. The other time that white supremacist monuments saw a huge upturn in construction was during the Civil Rights era. This was an obvious response to the regression towards equal rights and equity that black people attempted to achieve during that time. The first time period, 1900 to 1920, was in response to the ultimate snuffing out of the Reconstruction era, which was the response to, post-Civil War era America, where you had more black people elected to public spaces with more sovereignty than we'd ever seen before. So while global white supremacy was using symbols to validate its global conquest, Southern white supremacy was erecting them to maintain control in the American South, where they no longer held the same power to enslave black people. It's important to note that while monuments were being constructed to preserve psychological violence towards black people, that campaign merely enforced the physical violence that we were forced to endure. Between 1877 and 1950, this is a much better well-known fact at this point, during the era that we qualify as Jim Crow, there were over 4,000 lynchings. Again, this is a number that you can't trust, because a lynching is qualified as a murder of a black body, right? Not just somebody that's hung from a tree. And not only those murders made their way to public awareness and knowledge, just like they don't even in the era of the cell phone.
Right.
That's still nearly almost one a week for a century. And based on the 28-hour research, we know that that number is worse now. That number is worse now in this era than it was in antebellum. We got work to do. Meanwhile, the year 1877 becomes a crucial one for black folks in America, because it's the first year that we existed outside of the era of Reconstruction, which lasts from 1866 to 76, During that time, as I said, black people saw more political and socioeconomic progression than we've ever had in our history. There were black politicians, business owners, black sovereignty, and black communities saw unprecedented success. In New Orleans, we presented the U.S. with its first black lieutenant governor in the form of an erudite politician named Oscar Dunn. Dunn would die at the young age of 45 due to what rumors say was poisoned by the white elites who envied his comeuppance. While that can't be proven, what is indeed a fact is that directly following his death, white elites in the city made caricatures of him at that year's Mardi Gras masquerade balls by costuming as gorillas and basically degrading his namesake. Further, a monument that was originally supposed to be made to Dunn was replaced for a monument to Robert E. Lee instead. Robert E. Lee, general of the Confederacy. Yeah, boo this man. I think we've got to get some out of the system. 1, 2, 3, for Robert E. Lee. 1, 2, 3. And the ancestors rejoice. So, like Columbus, to places like Trinidad, where he's venerated, Robert E. Lee never set foot in New Orleans. In 1884, however, his 16-foot statue was placed atop a 68-foot phallic column in the middle of the city, angling towards the north in a symbolic act of defiance against the northern states that defeated the South in the Civil War. All of this was done with intention, of course. Another gross injustice that occurred during Reconstruction was the swift, violent reaction to Southern white supremacists. In Louisiana, a group of elite businessmen, politicians, and Confederate Army veterans formed a group called a paramilitary group called the Crescent City White League, which was basically the Louisiana version of the Ku Klux Klan. Louisiana is a former French colony. They got to be special in everything they do, so they couldn't just be the Klan. The CCW, Crescent City White League. They murdered some 3,000 black people during Reconstruction. One of the most infamous massacres they pulled off was at the Battle of Liberty Place in 1874 when they attempted to overthrow the Reconstruction-era government. The governor at the time was William P. Kellogg, for whom Oscar Dunn was lieutenant governor. He was a northern transplant, William P. Kellogg was, and the lieutenant governor after Oscar Dunn was P.B.S. Pinchback, a black man again who had replaced Oscar Dunn. During that massacre, the White League murdered 13 black and white men, both military officers and civilians. And you'd have to do the research to find out what's the context on that advertisement right here. But this is from Harper's Weekly in 1874. All right, so this is a cartoon depicting basically what's going on. I want to believe that they were trying to expose how foul, you know, things were going on in the South, and not endorsing it, but it's a fine line. Even to this day, you can't exactly tell. This is what happens 2 decades later, 1891. They would erect a monument to this act of domestic terrorism. In case there was any doubt as to the nature of this monument's purpose, in 1932, a qualifying plaque was placed on the monument stating that, quote, the national election of 1876 recognized white supremacy in the state and gave us our state. Now, that national election was a response to the paramilitary massacre that happened in 1874. All right? So again, politics as a response to what's happening on the ground. And I'll show you the more positive side of that when we get into taking down those work. However, you know, just like we organize, we must organize because our oppressors are always organizing. And this is how a lot of the progressions made during the Reconstruction era got peeled entirely back. The results of that election were undoubtedly influenced by the violent force applied only 2 years prior. By 1906, a monument would be erected to Jefferson Davis, a president of the Confederacy, and by 1915, one would be erected to P.G.T. Beauregard, a lieutenant in the Confederacy, and the only local New Orleanian in the Confederacy represented by a major state, by a major statue in the city. So of the 17 statues, only one of them was actually from New Orleans. So this is not like a local conversation. This was a regionally organized movement, the Cult of the Lost Cause. And so that's why you saw that little map that was dotted with all that. It was in all of the former Confederate states. There are organizations you can look up, like the Sons of Confederate Veterans, Daughters of the Confederacy, who actually did most of the fundraising, cake sales, bake sales for white supremacy. And that's how they funded getting a lot of these statues up there. It does not stop there. They also created curriculum around this called the Confederate Catechism, all right? A teacher friend of mine in New Orleans stumbled across a book, it was a children's book about Robert E. Lee, telling all the wonderful things about, you know, how he loved his mommy and he was a great kid, and all this kind of stuff. When we see what we see in the environment of today, it's a byproduct of the fact that this mythology is carried on generation to generation to generation, whether we know about it or not. But it becomes very tangible in Charlottesville in 2017, for example. Now, let's just recall really quickly what Dr. Welsing's qualification was as symbols. She said that they're here to pass on messages to support the origin, identity, and survival of the people. And it's through that lens that we've got to understand the hypocrisy of erecting symbols to white supremacists, much less sustaining them in a city like New Orleans, which has been predominantly black for 298 of its 302 years of existence. Like a lot of Caribbean colonies, by the time they brought in the African population and served as slaves in New Orleans, we outnumbered the oppressor by whatever the ratio was. But that's been the case for the majority of our history, all right? So these monuments are definitely not catering to the demographic in the city, that's for sure. It makes it even clearer that all of the street names as well, school names, public squares, and monuments to white supremacy in New Orleans were put there to sustain the false narrative of white supremacy, such that it would reign over black people in the city for the foreseeable future. Because these symbols obviously don't represent the majority of black citizens in New Orleans, much less an origin we need to identify with for survival. Conversely, if what you seek is the destruction of a people, then there's nothing better to do than torment them with the symbols of their degradation, enslavement, and genocide. This is really something that New Orleans suffers on a daily basis, and a testament to the slave state these monuments seek to maintain. We have historically ranked among the lowest in education in the U.S., among the highest in unemployment, with 53% poverty rate, one out of every two black men is unemployed in the city. We've got the biggest wage pay gap between black women and white men that exists in the entire country. If that's not the plantation revisited and reiterated, I don't know what is. In addition, as a result of that, we have high poverty, high crime rate. I moved there in 93. There were 424 murders that year. Highest per capita murder rate in the world. Next year, the same thing, 389 murders. So I say this comes from a very personal place. That's what I'm talking about. I've existed in that kind of environment with no clues as to what was going on and why. When you start to zoom out and see the roots and the history of this violence, you start to understand a lot better. In addition, we are the prison capital of all the world's history. Oklahoma took that title recently, but I think we still have some more collective years that we've been at. Incarcerated more people per capita than any other city or state in the world. Our biggest prison is called Angola, named after the plantation that it once was during slavery. The legacy of slavery has preserved itself in New Orleans, changed very little for its namesake. Its practices remain the same. This legacy of oppression by way of symbols has not been accepted without resistance, however. One of the earliest known acts of resistance was in 1954. It was a group of black preachers who organized a protest around Founders Day. Founders Day was once an annual ritual in New Orleans, wherein black students were made to stand in the hot sun and wait their turn behind white students to lay wreaths at the feet of a statue of John McDonough, who was one of the largest slave owners in Louisiana history, if not one of the largest in the country's history, actually. He owned some 1,800 slaves. Enslaved people. A protest organized by the black church put an end to all of this Founders Day business, though, and then 20 years later, in 1972, the New Orleans chapter of the Black Panthers faced off against former KKK Grand Wizard David Duke at the Robert E. Lee Monument and sent Duke running away. A year later, the black church picked back up the torch as Reverend Marie Gladys, one of the mothers of the movement, Reverend Marie Gladys recruited legendary civil rights activist and state senator Avery C. Alexander to organize for monument removal. Now, these were civil rights organizers. They were organizing around the same thing, black boys getting murdered, especially back in the 70s by police, but they incorporated all this in the conversation. So we're not the first to draw a connection between those points. 5 years later, in 1978, fellow Take 'Em Down NOLA lead organizer, co-founder of Take 'Em Down NOLA, longtime activist Malcolm Super. If we was at home, like, we turned it up for Malcolm Super. I give up to Malcolm. Yeah. Just like I like to give homage to ancestors, I definitely got to give the flowers while they're still here to Malcolm Super, the revolutionary scholar Leon Waters. You're going to see all kind of stuff in culture, right? You're going to see all kind of stuff. And I hope when Project Pilgrimage comes, I don't know if you've ever been on their tour, but oh, yes. All right, so y'all know about these guys. Hidden History Tours is going to give you the kind of knowledge and awareness about Louisiana and New Orleans history that is not in anybody's textbook. It's not in books that are published or sold in their stores, except for the one that they have something to do with. And they give the kind of narrative that ultimately people say, oh, that's nice. So I'm saying dollar signs. And then they get the little grant, and then they go do a reenactment of something that they were talking about for like 40 years. And, you know, that's on one side. But on the positive side is, you know, when it gets to young artists, young students, activists, you know, we can take that information and we can change our landscape, we can change our city. And so he, along with several other elders, continued to fight well into the 90s. By 1993, Malcolm and his cohorts received a major victory in the form of several school names, 26 of them, changing from former Confederate era racists like Governor William C. Claiborne and Governor Francis T. Nichols to significant contributors to African-American history, like Frederick Douglass and Langston Hughes. By 2006, like I said, about 26 school names were changed. Another huge victory from that era was the passage of a city ordinance declaring that all public symbols that represented the oppression of people to be public nuisances. All right? But by that definition, half the city was and still is up for reupholstery. By 2015, when Mayor Mitch Landrieu would enter this conversation, he would use this very ordinance to call for the removal of four Confederate monuments in the city without ever citing the activists that created that ordinance or the fact that he voted to keep Confederate flags on license plates when he was lieutenant governor, but that's another story. He wasn't woke yet. Yeah, exactly. I'm not sure he's woke. You know, it happens in stages. So before that ever happened, though, I would sit in a lecture presented by Malcolm and his partner, Leon Waters, and I would have my worldview change forever. It was 2010, as I told y'all. I saw this map of the city gridded in the names of our antebellum oppressors. My blood boiled. It's like a bonfire went off in my head. No time for the light bulb. I was equally enraged and excited because I just knew, well, first of all, I was mad because I realized that all of the trauma that I finished talking about, from the murder rate, crime, poverty, all this kind of stuff, is visited on black people in New Orleans. It's not by coincidence, it's by design. Literal design, because we know that those symbols reflect the system. They reflect the people in power who put them there, also put the litigation and the policy in place to keep us in the place that we are. I was also excited because I assumed that in the room in which I sat, which was comprised mostly of black intellectuals and artists in New Orleans, that everyone would see what I saw. Documented evidence of the crime of white supremacy left by none other than the culprits themselves. Armed with information like this, I just knew we would just be ready to rise up in rebellion against our oppressors, but I was wrong. People said things like, but it's a part of history. It needs to be preserved. My response was, we just paid our government about 5-7 years ago to go to a whole nother country out here and like knock down the monument of their great pillar of, you know, civilization, Saddam Hussein. And our tax dollars paid for that. And you supported that. So how do you support now your tax dollars paying for the opposite? When it's these people that literally oppressed your ancestors, your bloodline. That's at least how I saw it. A couple of people in the room saw it the same way, but for the most part, the room was kind of ambivalent. It would take about another 5 years before my community and the planet at large was ready to act, and as usual, the spark to set off the fire came in the form of black death, like Emmett Till, the 14-year-old murder victim from Chicago that catalyzed the civil rights movement. The modern-day Black Lives Matter movement would be ignited by the deaths of Trayvon Martin in 2012, Mike Brown in 2014, and a countless list of other names too long to count. Just know that in North America, as I said earlier, a black person is killed by a racist cop or vigilante, and that violence is sanctioned nearly daily, and our killers usually go unpunished. That's at least 5 times worse than our documented numbers during the Jim Crow era. After Mike Brown's death and the non-indictment of killer cop Darren Wilson in 2014, some friends and I formed the first other chapter of BYP 100, or Black People Project 100. which is basically the organizing body of the Black Lives Matter movement. We staged our first protest, the Rally for Mike Brown, directly beneath Robbie Lee's statue in Lee Circle, because at that moment is when the light bulbs go off and I'm connecting the dots, and I'm like, I wanted us to be in the place that literally degrades black life and its value, talking about some Black Lives Matter, and hopefully we can draw those contradictions out. On November 30th, 2014, we debuted the petition to remove Robbie Lee. Hundreds of people signed. 6 months later, we staged our second action, where we burned the Confederate flag on the steps of the Robbie Lee Monument. Our actions turned out to be prescient, because only a few months later, Dillard walked into a black church in South Carolina and murdered 9 of its members. His social media pages show him holding guns next to Confederate flags, making promises of a race war. After that, the entire country started to respond to racist symbols like never before. Of course, we got our great dear sister, Bree Newsom, who climbed up the flagpole. Without whom we would not have our namesake, because after she did that, the hashtag take them down, take them all down trended, and we continued our activism. We wanted to connect with that and push that conversation forward. So we became Take Them Down Note. But before even that happens, a few days later, the governor of South Carolina would follow suit and remove the flag permanently, because Nikki Haley wanted to be on the right side of history for a second. I had such high hopes. Just a nanosecond. She played that. I don't know, she's drinking the orange juice now. Anyway, she wasn't the only one who wanted to ride the wave. State and city leaders all throughout the South jumped on this, right? And so Mitch Landrieu jumps in on June 24th, 2015, and he announces that he wants 4 Miamis to come down. Those happen to be Robbie Lee, PGT Beauregard, Jefferson Davis, and about a limited place monument, the ones which we call a white supremacist statue, made denim or whatever. But, because that language is so messed up, right? We kill 11 people in this battle of living place up there. He jumps in that conversation. He calls for a 60-day period of conversation about the issue. We responded by burning another flag and saying, that's nice, Mr. Mayor, but what about the other 100 symbols to white supremacy in the city? And after we burned that flag, we went on to carry on other actions, and we created ourselves in July of 2015. All right? Maybe I should read this mission statement real quick. Take Them Down, NOLA is a black-led, multiracial, intergenerational coalition comprised of activists, artists, educators, and working-class people committed to the removal of all symbols of white supremacy in New Orleans as a part of the greater push for racial and economic justice. Basically, symbols reflect systems, all right? We're not just out here trying to push down a rock and metal. We're talking about the ways that these things reflect our oppression. We went on from there to have our first action on August 9th. Before we even did that, we had a little intervention on a night called White Linen Night, where we projected images of, I cannot remember this ancestor's name, but it's an infamous picture. We all know this photo. He actually was an escaped enslaved person from Mississippi who escaped to Baton Rouge during the Civil War. So it's fitting that he would still be getting acknowledged right here in the center of New Orleans. But we wanted to show, okay, you want to venerate this guy, this is what you venerate. And we put his direct quotes on to the Robbie Lee Monument, where he basically says in the letter to his wife that, you know, this is good. This is a necessary evil for the savage people of Africa. This will lead to their improvement and betterment, yada, yada, yada. On August 9th, we held our first action. It was 4 days before the first day of public hearings on the monuments. Our action catalyzed our base and secured a strong turnout for the August 13th hearings. And we expanded the conversation and took it to Andrew Jackson. As you might be able to tell right there, that wasn't one of the monuments on the list. We canvassed major neighborhoods in our city and states, 3 of our own public forums, all right? And then when it got to November, and there was still no word from the city, despite, you know, these very well-attended forums, as you can see. We decided to do another action in the French Quarter. And this one was going to be centered on Andrew Jackson, the monument that is probably even more infamous than Robbie Lee was. We wanted to highlight some of the other prominent racist statuary in the city, besides what the mayor was talking about. And also be in the French Quarter where all the money is generated and hit the city where it would hurt them the most, in their pockets. First Quarter is the heart of New Orleans' $8 billion number one tourism industry in the world. We strategically planned that action during Bayou Classic, which is the biggest black college football game in the U.S., bringing in black tourists from all over the country to the city by the thousands. All right? We left signs by Andrew Jackson, depicting him for what he truly was, a slave of hundreds of Africans and a genocidal architect of the Trail of Tears, which killed thousands of indigenous Native Americans. And that's my good sister and co-founder of Take It Down Nola right there, Angela Kinlaw, continues to do amazing work. Speaking of symbols and systems, y'all can look up residents of Gordon Plaza, fully funded relocation for the residents of Gordon Plaza. We have black people who have been living on toxic soil for some 40 years, babies being born with cancer. And we have coalitions that are, you know, our brothers and sister coalitions. The People's Assembly has been doing amazing work that she's been a huge spearhead of to, you know, bring that conversation to the fore, because we understand this is a lot more than just the symbols we see, but the way it plays out. We left the KKK hood on the head of Supreme Court Judge E.D. White, and a sign that read, "This is what a terrorist looks like." White was a member of the Crescent City White League that I told you about before. The statue stands outside of New Orleans Federal Court. He was a member of the Louisiana and the National U.S. Supreme Court, all right? And he was also one who presided over the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, which legislated segregation for the next 60 years to come. All right, so again, symbols, systems. You wonder why you go up in here, can't get no justice, can't no peace, right? He's still standing in front of the Louisiana Supreme Court. We went around the corner to a statue of Bienville. Bienville is basically our Columbus, all right? He's the guy who founded New Orleans as a French colonizer. We left a sign on him in red, "I brought slavery here," on the neck of the statue of him. We also left a sign on the Native indigenous chieftain who was slumped over right there, who was grossly misrepresented, by the way. I believe that's supposed to be a Chittimacha Native indigenous person. They did not even wear headdresses like this, so it's a stereotypical depiction. But, you know, we put a little sign on there to put him in context, because he slumped over in defeat on purpose, and we wanted to tell the rest of that story. Gave us the Bible, stole our land. That's what that says. Our message was heard loud and clear. Canvassed among the thousands of Bayou Classic attendees and took pictures and posted them to social media. About 10 days later, whoop-de-whoop, after having surpassed their 60 days by at least another 100, City Council finally issued a statement saying that they would want to hold a hearing on the monuments. It's very important to note that Supreme Court building is directly next to the police precinct in the First Quarter. So this is not, you know, off of their purview at all, and they definitely responded to what we did. Oh yeah, that's the Battle of Liberty Place monument. Got some kind of red stuff on it. Got great creative organizers. So by December 17th, after they wanted to have another hearing to talk about what they were going to do with it, we were like, it's decision time. We talked about, I couldn't get her in the picture, but that's my homegirl Charm. She gave an amazing speech that day. A lot of people didn't even organize with us, but they showed up for these kind of, you know, City Council here. So that, again, is the power of organizing. A lot of what Janice got me doing while I'm here is talking to people about the efficacy of putting people in the streets and what that does to affect public discourse, public actions, policy, what have you, all right? And so that's how that affected that. By December 17th, as you can see, we had an epic victory. City Council voted 6-1 to remove the monuments. That's mother of the movement, Marie Galatas. She's been dreaming about this since the 70s. She said, I used to have dreams. She had dreams of seeing statues falling all up and down the East Coast. And so it's powerful to see that come to fruition. One of the most memorable moments of that day was witnessing New Orleans civil rights legend, organizer with CORE, freedom rider Jerome Smith, stand before the City Council and state while the removal of the monuments is a significant and necessary act. He said that in the 60s, he and his fellow organizers worked for the removal of whites only and colored only signs around the South. They were pushing for a change in the vocabulary, such that the white supremacist state would have to change the way that they talked to them. He said that removing symbols to white supremacy was a natural evolution of that conversation, a further necessary change in the nature of the conversation between the white supremacist state and the majority black population in New Orleans that it oppressed. But as my Trinidadian comrade Shabaka Cambon says, removal of white supremacist symbols represents the new front line in the struggle for black liberation and human rights. That wasn't the end of the story. Of course, they clapped back. People like the son of the declare a veteran, they filed a lawsuit the very next day. That stayed pinned up in courts for the next 15 months. We continued to do our actions. We continued to resist. We put about 500, 1,000, 3,000 people in the streets to, you know, protest not only the four that were up for grabs, but Andrew Jackson. This is an amazing picture because if you look in the back, you can see police on horseback in front of the old state, you know, representative on horseback. If that ain't history repeating itself, I don't know what is. And finally, they all came down, and when they did, we did our own celebration. We called it the Second Line for White Supremacy. You know, the city did this stuff in the dark of the night because they were so scared of, you know, threats to vigilantes and whatnot. But anyway, this is the takedowns. We had April 24th, the battle that took place right here down. On May 4th, Jefferson Davis comes down. On May 11th, P.G. Durbar comes down. And then last but not least, on May 19th, Malcolm X's birthday, we gave him a gift. And we sent Bobby Lee home to the package. So our work continues, y'all, but, you know, basically, we still got so much more to do in the city, but that's about where that culminated. I just want to end it really quickly with another quote from Baldwin. He said another thing about history. An invented past can never be used. It cracks and crumbles under the pressure of life like clay in a dry season. Welcome to the dry season of white supremacy. Now is the time to crack and crumble that invented past, one symbol, one symptom of its greatest system at a time. Thank you.
$250 million in a new youth jail instead of $250 million in housing for young people and their families. And so this conversation about symbols reflecting a system is not absent here in Seattle. It just looks different. We co-opt the symbols of other folks and then continue to put the same white supremacist policies behind that. Right, so I think it's very important here in the Pacific Northwest that we don't allow ourselves to be convinced that these problems only exist in the South. They exist here as well, and they exist here in a different form. So I really hope that we can grapple with what does this sort of organizing, what does it look like to take down symbols of white supremacy? What does it look like then once we take the symbols down to actually make sure the system that put them in place is dismantled and transformed? Word. I'm gonna do a poem that probably some of y'all have heard before, but for me it's kind of a mantra of what I hope we do. Is that cool?
Yeah.
You'll probably hear it again. I don't really care if it's cool or not. I just ask so you feel invited. Consent to sexy, you know?
Let's go down to the river to pray. Studying about those good old days and to show where the golden crown. Good Lord, show me the way. Oh, family, let's go down. Let's go down. Don't you want to go down? Oh, family.
I can hear my Baba in the front of the chapel singing. She makes her way over to me, leans down and says, baby, let's go down to the river to pray. We
make our way down the mountainside into the valley below, the place where the water settles. She tells me to watch how water moves, how it starts in the sky above, makes its way down the mountainside, how it settles in the place where it's most needed, reminds me that I must learn to move like water, how to settle in the place where I am most needed. Shows me how water will move around, over, or through a thing if it has to. Reminds me that I must learn how to move over, around, or through a thing if I have to. She tells me that my body and water are one and the same thing. That my body, water, and justice are one and the same thing, and they must all learn to move in the same way. She tells me that justice is just us being just us. Without us, there is no justice. And just in case I missed it, she says it again. Justice is just us being just us. Without us, there is no justice. Without us, there is no resistance. Without us, the system persists in its defiance, dividing us further from the divinity that is our unity with our mother. Dividing us further from the divinity that is our unity with each other. That's when cash rules everything around me as the man is steadily auctioning off stock in my body, steadily breaking my attempts to break free. Understand there can't be no fair trade agreements when black and brown bodies are still sold as stocks and bonds. And politicians sell out their wealth by using our bodies. How they build these jail cells, black and brown bodies markedly marketed, targeted, murdered extrajudiciously with impunity, not just locally but globally by the same hands that stole our families from our motherland, the same hands that brought us to someone else's motherland, the same hands that are feed us to this motherland, the same hands that sell us back our motherland overprocessed and overpriced till we become underfed. But understand that in this place we are still resilient. We are still living people. We are still here people in the land of the free, the home of the slave. Shit. I keep getting that wrong. The land of the free, the home of the brave. Did anyone else notice that they make their stories invisible? Did anyone else notice that the natives amongst us have been made invisible in the stories and the histories that we tell? No one asked, so they don't have to tell the truth as these rivers run red around us. And I start to wonder what it is. I think it might be these politics, many ticks. Blood-sucking politicians where the only thing redder than their fangs is their blood-stained hands. Look at them elbow deep in the cookie jar. Let's call the cookie jar capitalism. Who pays the toll for this feudalism? The 10% prosper on bodies and profits while the rest of us race to the bottom in chains and body bags to be buried. We need more fair trade agreements where the only thing fairly traded is our rage against this machine. A machine that'll have you believe you can never have enough. You'll never be enough. But see, enough is 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 enough. We just said it was enough. My Baba brings me back to center. Tells me to look down in the river and ask me what I see. I think it's a trick question. It's a mirror. Baba, I see me. She says, that's right. You see you. And you have to understand that justice is what love looks like in public. And if you cannot learn to love yourself, you cannot love anyone else. And since justice is just us being just us, it all first starts with love. And there's always been enough love if we're willing to share it. If we're willing to be like water, willing to move like water, willing to settle in the place where we are most needed, willing to move over, around, or through a thing if you have to. Understand that love, water, and justice will move over, around, or through a thing if it has to. Because justice is just us being just us. Without us, there is no justice. Justice is just us being just us. Without us, there is no justice. Justice is just us being just us. Without us, there is no justice. Thank you, y'all. Really a
want like a, they want like some magic for it. And really, it looks magical, but it's just hard work of us being ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, even speaking of what you were saying with the poem, like just being yourself is it sounds so simple. But I mean, when the whole system is designed to get you doing that, like just even finding courage to, you know, speak like the most obvious truth, the most obvious elephant, which shouldn't even be in the room in the first place, is hard to call out. So you can get that back to that point of like when I first learned about this stuff, I'm amongst people who I've been in community with for a long time, still in community with, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. Like, you know, the hardest part is like finding the courage to find your tongue. You know what I'm saying? These people that I know, like in different circumstances, might have spoken that truth. Or just to be that pressure of like, oh, I might do something. Like, I battled that with that myself. Like, I've seen like Alicia Garza sit on a panel and say the same thing, like the one of the authors of the Black Lives Matter movement, and just like speaking to the weight of that, like, wow, sometimes I wish I didn't even say it. And she said a thing that's like, my God, my life matters. I gotta, you know what I'm saying? But that creates war and tension. But that should tell you everything about the nature of the system in the first place. If me just saying that I want to be myself, I don't want to be degraded. Can you please not spit on me? Can you not, like, you know, spit on my ancestors? Can you not, you know, disrespect the land that we're on? Can we acknowledge who the majority demographic is here, even? Basic stuff, you know what I mean? But that's the power of any narrative that's backed by violence. You know what I'm saying? And our challenge is to try to put forth the truth without, you know, resorting to violence. And so that's really not as easy as just be yourself. You know what I'm saying? Even though that's what you're trying to get to. So, it's a lot because it taught me a lot about like the whole Stockholm syndrome of oppression in so many different forms, you know, and something that's like a challenge to like develop and retain empathy for, you know what I'm saying? But at the same time, not be stagnated by, because it's always a struggle, I'm sure you know, as organizers to like take care of yourself and stay in the fight, you know? And so, for me, I was naive enough to think that this was obvious. But I'm also, in case y'all might be able to tell, like I'm not New Orleans born, I'm New Orleans blood born. Like my ancestors are 7-8 generations, probably more deep. I was born in Brooklyn at first. That's the part of the story I didn't even get to. I'm just like, you know, having a different lens on reality. And then when I see this, like, well, the fuck, you know what I'm saying? Like, this should not be. And for a lot of people, you know, I just had this conversation with my cousin the other day. You know, talking about like blackface, because we also have a Mardi Gras crew that wears blackface over here. You might have heard about that in some of our recent conversation. And this kid has been commissioned to do art for them, and he did it beautifully because he's an amazing artist. I'm like, bro, you know what this is, right? It's like, man, you know, it's all in the culture, bro. It's embedded, you know what I'm saying? He's from New Orleans. So those things don't necessarily occur like that. You know, it takes some time to like peel back lens.
No, that's real. You know, thinking a lot about what knowledge does for people to be able to open their eyes. And as a poet, as a storyteller, I feel like that's almost essential to creating spaces where people can see things. But one of the things I struggle with, and I was thinking about this after you talked about Slam, I probably watched that movie like 50 times. But just thinking about the role that art plays in opening people's eyes, the storytellers, but also as artists, especially those who get to travel for our craft, how consumption becomes a part of it. And I'm wondering for like an audience like this one, because I'm just gonna call it out, we white Seattle. how can folks who maybe the stories we tell they're a part of, but it's not their experience, how can they participate in the story beyond consumption?
That's an excellent question. And as well as you went that direction, because I'm thinking about it just in terms of just us sitting up here as the official organizing taught me so much is that, you know, this is a participatory communal dynamic, whereas, you know, because we're speakers, throughout history that's been looked at as like one of the most powerful spiritual gifts you can have, because you can communicate, you can control, you can manipulate, you can do good or evil with, you know. But at the same time, that don't mean you got the whole story. That don't even mean that once you give the story, you know what the hell to do with it. And I find that I have my particular niche, but there's amazing people that just will like cook up, you know, a storm, literally. Like, we're not gonna have this fundraiser if they're not in the kitchen. We're not gonna have all these t-shirts over here if, you know, Tina's not an amazing graphic designer. You know what I'm saying? We're not gonna have even the information that's gonna inform my art if it's not for, you know, the Malcolm and Leons who have been in the ground doing this for decades. So I think about it in terms of like the consumptive nature all around. Like, even as an artist, I gotta stop myself from just being, you know, a consumer of information and then give out. And then what do you do with it after that? I got to a point where I realized, again, this was becoming a genre of Black Lives Matter poems. And I was like, there's a nasty dynamic happening right here that I saw. Danette Smith's got an amazing poem about that. It's real simple, but he's a great poet out of Minnesota. Like, you're in poetry, brother, everything that. And he's talking about something about, it's kind of like critiquing the LG genre. And just like, what does the poet even do after you finish like memorializing the umpteenth black body, and then you get paid a stipend to go up, you know, do that again. And now you participate in the very system that got rid of the black bodies, which is capitalism, which put a dollar sign on all of our existence in the first place. So that's a whole another wormhole of a conversation of just like, what do you do about actually bringing the thing to fruition that you're fighting for? And I found the more I can embody the opposite of that principle, you know what I'm saying, the more that I can allow myself to fall back and just do the thing because it needs to be done. That's what Take a Bow was for me, and it exposed me to so many different organized communities in the city of New Orleans and nationally and internationally who did similar work where this ain't never had nothing to do about a dollar sign. If anything, it had to do the opposite, is that my people not eating, and they need access, they need water, they need food, they need non-toxic ground to be on, you know, to live on. What can we do to make that happen? And so, as a poet, I lend my voice, you know, but it's a complicated wormhole to go down to try to make sense of even while I'm sitting here, but it's something that we're always in contention with. And I think in terms of just like the white folks who show up, because I think about this for a majority black city, so I think about it for my black people too, you know. Once we finish on the bullhorn, you are hopefully going home differently, but hopefully you're not just going home, you know what I'm saying? The least you could do is, as your lens is altered, is, you know, we've been like socio-technocratically, you know, spoiled and manipulated. We up here, I'm taking Talon Macy words, I ain't like, but we are here like living in this digital like bubble. The least you can do is, if it's gonna control that much time and space of ours, is renegotiate the message that we're gonna subscribe to out there and put out there, like post this, repost this, hashtag this, make this thing blow up, make this conversation be the standard. And we've done some of that, and there's a lot of that. So now it's like, okay, now bring it back to life. Get back in the street. Because, you know, we had some successful things where, like, we would post stuff on social media, city council would see it, they'd be like, and then they would do something. They only did that because they just saw us in the street, too. So they knew, oh, they're going to bring 100 next time, they're going to bring 500, 1,000. Okay, we better react, we better respond.
And that is beautiful about how storytelling can be generative and action. You know, and I think a huge part of that is, as storytellers, getting ourselves beyond. So Nina Simone and Octavia Butler are two artists that really guide some of my principles. Nina Simone says the role of an artist is to show what is now, to tell a story. And Octavia Butler talks about our power to manifest, how what we write, what we talk about, what we create can actually manifest a reality. And in our stories, also speaking to the vision of the world that we want, I think is incredibly powerful. You know, one of the thoughts I had while I was listening to you talk was, we've been trying to stop our county from building this stupid youth jail that they still built. And now we're at the place where we're trying to imagine, what does repurposing it look like? What else could it be? And one of the questions people asked us early on was, well, if we don't build a youth jail, what do you want us to build? And, you know, that was the question I had, like, as all these monuments come down, which is important, you know, for dismantling the system and calling out these stories that the victor tells for the purpose of oppression, what story do you put in place? What monuments do you put in place? What reminders and history is important to maybe raise up in those spaces?
Yeah, that's a great question. And speaking of that, I was talking to Mark about that on the way in. We got the exact same thing. Like, some of my comrades just finished, you know, standing in front of city council because they're about to put up another jail, and they're trying to smuggle it in on the Trojan horse of mental health, which is BS, because we had a governor who got rid of all of the mental health facilities, and now you're going to bring them back as jail. And so Yeah, for us, the most immediate thing we call out is like, yo, we got a city budget, $742 million or something like that. 63% goes to prisons and jails. So when you already have 63%, you know what I'm saying? And we're not the only ones like that. You know what I mean? We got people like Jacksonville's like that. Nationally, our budget, we just approved like an $800 billion, a $718 billion military budget. You know what I'm saying? So the correlate is still there. And they're just valuing what Big Brother values up there. And so what we see, obviously, is like, okay, 1% goes to jobs, 3% goes to children and families. That's actually an easy fix, fam. Like, you wouldn't need to incarcerate nobody if you sliced out half of that prison budget. And, you know, slice the whole thing, but, you know, slice out half of that, and you wouldn't even have none of these issues, because we got a number one tourist ministry in the world. It's $8 billion. How people can't eat, how people can't, you know, get basic needs, right? And so that's systemically. We talk about symbolically. Part of what this work has done is this made me, as we were talking before, like, look even more just like lovingly and like in respect and admiration to like the diaspora, especially in like the Caribbean, South America. And the irony is, you know, it's a plus and a minus hugely, because on the one hand, they outdo us all day on like venerating revolutionary ancestors. You go to Bahia, Brazil, number one black population in the West, you got Zumbi, who's there, basically there, Shaka Zulu, the Harriet Tubman. You go to Colombia, you got Becos Biojo, and that's there in the Shaka Zulu. You go to Martinique in the Caribbean, you got Franz Fanon everywhere. You got Aung San Suu Kyi everywhere. He's a revolutionary, you know what I'm saying, smash the whole state and like bring it back to the people type of freedom fighters. And yet, their socioeconomic disposition is probably as bad, if not worse, than us, right? And Brazil is 17 a day compared to the one a day in terms of, you know, police killing, you know, black people. So a symbol is just the tip of the iceberg. We can envision that, but I think in America, the irony of that, the reason why it's even more important for the oppressor to keep his face and name everywhere, because you don't even believe that he would have that kind of leverage point because of the kind of access that we have in this country to capital and to all of the things that would like allow us something closer to equity. If you go to the Caribbean, if you go to South America, they're lower on the capitalist totem pole. So they're gonna get kicked harder. They're gonna get stomped deeper into the ground. But here it's like, you know, give us a little comeuppance in the Reconstruction era, you see what happened in 10 years. You know, so you got black councilmen, congressmen from here to South Carolina, from New Orleans to South Carolina. So, you know, the symbols is just a beginning of the conversation.
And it's listening to you say those numbers, I only got even more angry at Seattle. You know what our city budget is? $6.1 billion.
Oh, I forgot. We had like tech plans.
$6.1 billion, y'all. Why we got lots of folks without homes? It's crazy. It's crazy. You know, so then it makes me think about whole stories. Like, how do we tell whole stories that acknowledge full history, but also affirm identities? You know, I think about being a student in a classroom. And I remember I got to interview Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz earlier, or last year, and I read her student version of People's Indigenous History. It's not a people's history, but it's really from the focal point of Indigenous folks, and it's from the perspective of honoring the resilience of Indigenous people, of calling out that like Indigenous folks had full civilizations here, trade routes, ways of being, and we're not just some group that was easily taken over. And so when I think about telling whole stories, it's like, how do we not just tell the whole bad side of the story, but how do we also tell a side of the story that, you know, when I think about black folks, lets us know about our resilience and our health and our strength and all the things that we've been doing. What are y'all doing to get those whole stories out?
So we got some t-shirts over there that kind of represent that part of the mission. It's called Take Them Down, Build Them Up. So a lot of people think we're just out here rabble-rising, we want to smash everything. We want to smash everything that's a problem, and that's unfortunately half the city. But in terms of building up, the irony of New Orleans and Louisiana history, the irony is that it became so necessary to really co-opt it because of how powerful it was. And so those elders that I showed you up there, the first thing I learned about from them was my image. The very next thing I learned which was, you know, not too long after that. It was 2010 when I met them. I learned that. The very next year was the bicentennial of the 1811 enslaved people revolt. And so a lot of people know about it now because, you know, they got a big reenactment that just happened. But they've been talking about this for 30 years. There's a book that's already out that they did with a writer named Albert Thrasher that tells that story. And we want to lift those up because nobody learns that in school.
Right.
You know what I mean? I had to bring my students when I was a teacher on those tours so they can learn about it. But it's not taught in mass. And so we want to lift that up. We want to be intentional about lifting up the stories of revolutionaries and freedom fighters. Our zine that I'm selling over there is aimed towards documenting, you know, the things that they did to make these narratives keep going, like the 1954 Founders Day protests. That stuff, you can't even Google it. Like, I couldn't find any of that. I got that from, like, elders who passed the story down. So it's all over the place, and the resistance has to be thick and deep when you got a 65% black population that's been there for 300 years. But so does the violence, and we only get the story of the violence. So 1811 is one of the most penultimate. Our zine is a way that we preserve that. Most of us are educators, so we work on getting that stuff inside the schools. And then a lot of the resistance work is not necessarily even just monuments of slavery oriented. You know what I'm saying? Some of the stuff is like, what's happening right now? You know, we got black people living on toxic soil right now. They need to move off of that like 10 years ago. So all of those different ways, you know, and all of the different ways that we continue to organize, you know, ways we keep pushing out to the community.
Have y'all felt at all since, I know y'all taken out 4 monuments yet, have you felt like the energy has stalled ever? And if so, like, how do y'all re-energize to do the work? Because I, you know, we've been in this known in each jail fight for 7 years. And we definitely had some ebbs and flows of energy. You know, I'm interested in knowing how do y'all keep it going?
Yeah, I mean, that's a struggle because, I mean, it's always doing that because where's the information coming from? Who's controlling that narrative is definitely not grassroots organizers with no money. All right, so our competition is always with this really well-funded machine that's designed to tell you lies all day. And once you become aware or radicalized, as some people like to call us, and that becomes a lifestyle. You know what I'm saying? And your lifestyle becomes, okay, well, what can I find? This an alternative to the fake news that's been in existence for 300 years. It's the only thing he did right was call it out. And what can I do to like constantly feed myself? And this is another thing that becomes a practice in community. You know what I'm saying? Like, we in meetings 2 to 3 times, some of us nightly. I ain't built like that because I gotta get my heart on. But some of us, and that becomes a lifestyle. You know it well. Like, ain't nobody paying for these meetings. But that's where it's a whole dynamic and a whole consciousness that we're cultivating amongst each other and hoping that we can make go viral, make people buy into, for lack of a less capitalist term. Make people believe in enough to realize that, okay, I can't necessarily be present for all this. But back to your question before, though, about not just being a consumer, you know, be an investor, still on some capitalist language, but be a supporter, like, be a collaborator, like, you know what I'm saying? If you can't be in those spaces because, you know, you're incapacitated, you got, you know, family, things you got to attend to, what have you, there's always somebody you know that knows somebody, especially in Seattle, I know, that's doing some kind of work. How can I help push that work forward? And how can I be a resistance? How can I be a blockage to the work that's working against us? You know what I mean? Whether that's gentrification, whether that's, you know, a messed up curriculum, you know, housing, whatever the situation is. But, you know, us as organizers, we make that our daily diet. So how much can you consume that is going to actually feed and generate the kind of change you want to see in the world? And how much can you, like, eradicate this, you know, holding it back.
So I was told I have to stop it at 9, but I'm five minutes late on the stage. I'm gonna be a little later. But I have one more question because you know, I think a lot about like what you're saying about being an accomplice, being in the work, and I think being in the work wherever you are. Organizing is not something that you do part time. Organizing happens in every facet of your life. I mean, like y'all, I could find something to organize in the grocery store. So I think it is, especially, you know, everybody goes to the grocery store, unless you order your food on Instacart. But I got jokes for days, y'all. But, you know, what I'm wondering about is,
first to develop principles around how you just live in your daily life. Like, if you had to give people a few things, because you mentioned the ISIS papers, and I was like, oh, as long as people up in here ain't ready, y'all gonna go Google and be like, ah. But like, what would you recommend is like just some starting points for people to start developing that lens that helps you see in your everyday life where there is an opportunity to be organizing?
Man, that's why I feel like as artists we kind of spoil, you know what I mean? Like, because we get inundated with that stuff. What happened for me was like, artistry was organizing me since I was a kid, you know? I named myself after a group my dad gave me, you know what I'm saying? Tribe Called Quest, so I like how they sound, boom. You know what I'm saying? That's me when I decided I'm a poet. You know, slam, poetry, that community first was the thing that would like give me access points. Being around a very strong Afrocentric community in my college in Tallahassee, shout out to FAMU. You know, that's why I discovered a lot of that kind of stuff. And
eventually, it's just like you plant enough seeds. It's like the opposite of a toxin. If I like poison this ground, I can't grow nothing in. But if I heal this ground, I can't put no poison in. And so it gets to the point where, like, you know, we talked about diet earlier. Being exposed to those kind of communities, telling me things like, oh, your body is 70% water, and, you know, you can put this in your body and change it, and, you know, do this kind of yoga and eat this kind of food, and that kind of thing made me realize, okay, well, that feels great for me. But I'm looking around, and a lot of people will never have access to even knowing that's a thing, much less being able to internalize it. And it's a struggle once you start internalizing, because it don't must be looking good, you know what I'm saying? Like, all the different toxins that's always negative for you, you know what I'm saying? And so that's the process, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm knocking on 40 soon. And, you know, I'm finally getting to a place where I can systematize, like, nah, actually, I need this for life, so I'm not going to do something different. But that's a process, you know?
Yeah, so I'm going to reflect back a few things that I heard. The first was, it's a process. You know, I think we go to events like this, we're in these spaces, and we forget that getting to this level of sight really takes time. Like, we need to unlearn and undo the colonization that's been put on us so we can get to the place of discovering who we were outside of colonization. The other thing I heard was putting yourself in the space. So if you're really wanting to grow your knowledge and your principles, put yourself in more spaces like this. Put yourself at arts events. Yo, Youth Speaks is about to start their quarterly slams. And those young people drop gems. They drop knowledge. And I never take for granted the opportunity to be with young people or young artists because they see things from a place, to be honest, that is less colonized right now. They've been living here less time to take on the system that tells you there's a way you're supposed to be. So I take young people's knowledge, their sight, very seriously. So get to some of You Speak slams, and then be about doing the work without fear of doing it wrong. Yeah. You're going to do it wrong sometimes, and you're going to get called out. And it's okay to get called out because being called out is how we figure out how to get right. You gotta be okay with it. You know, we gotta deal with our egos, and that's a part of our healing work. So I would strongly encourage everyone in here to be doing your own healing work. It doesn't really matter what background you're from. We've all been damaged by racial attacks. So,
I was talking to, I really was wishing we could, like, open up and hear from folk a bit, but I've been calling y'all into this conversation a bit. I was talking to Nathan in the beginning, and we were talking about this conversation me and Michelangelo actually had. Y'all can Google that or whatever, but I was critical of some of his ways of approaching conversation as a white person with privilege who I felt like was ignorant to and dismissive of the people that created the space for the conversation to happen. And so I was just making a point to Nathan that, like, this is critical work. It's not just critical, as double the times for you, right? It's not just critical in terms of it's necessary, but we are always in the work of critiquing. And that can be kind of scary, because you might step in the room like, ooh, I'm not, you know, woke enough for this conversation. I'm not, you know, black enough. I ain't, you know, whatever the thing is. And you might get called out, you know what I'm saying? But it's going to be critical conversation because it's critical work, and you might get critiqued within those criticisms. But if you came to that space, you got to be okay with it. I've been called out before, you know what I'm saying? I got things that I've said that were, you know, too much this, too much that, whether it's under the lens of heteronormativity, capitalism, not white supremacy, I think I was kind of born. In other words, you know what I'm saying? Where, like, you know, we all inherit some form of that privilege if you're born in America, especially. If you're born male, yeah, and if you're born white male, fact it's work, you know what I'm saying? And the first work is to humble yourself, and then you can step into that arena.
Please support our artists. All right, work.
Thank you, Seattle.